This is Six Music.
Available at the Six Music website and every morning at 4 a.m. BBC Radio Six Music documentaries.
Telling the stories in music that matter.
It was the first airing it's ever had anywhere.
Really?
My mother thought the lyrics were dirty.
Baby, baby, brush the dust of youth from off your shoulder.
From the story of pop to Marvin Gaye.
You know, I'm a lot of people and a lot of things, and I just have to express all of me.
Now, Six Music Documentaries present Master Tapes.
Welcome to Master Tapes. That's Brinsley Ford playing live for our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. Brinsley was frontman and songwriter with the band Aswad, who in 1988 scored a number one hit with Don't Turn Around. But the band had had a long career before that. In this programme, we'll take Brinsley back to 1981 and the making of New Chapter, one of the most significant albums in the story of British reggae. It included songs such as African Children, Candles, Natural Progression and Love Fire.
Where does the fire of love kindle first? In the heart,
in the hearts of every man.
Taking your chances, not knowing why ever. To give love to receive
natural progression. Natural progression.
African children.
Brinsley Ford, welcome to Master Tapes. We're
Thank
taking
you
it back
Thank
to 1981 this afternoon. But the history of Aswad, first of all, you'd formed the band in 1974?
It was around 74. I was kind of working in a record shop. It was a couple of friends who were trying to start a business. It later became to be Venture Records. And so I was really looking for musicians and looking for the right musicians, I think. Mm. I mean, I think there was one occasion that Drummy came in and...
That's Drummy Zeb, Angus Gaye, who was the drummer in the band throughout.
Yeah. Drummy came in and said he was playing with a few other people. And I said, no, with this band, you've got to be playing with this band and this band alone. History goes that later on we went to look for him.
Right.
But it really kicked off. I'd been writing songs. And I think George returned from Jamaica, George Oban, the bass player. So he got back the early part of 75, I think. So that was, yeah, really when it kicked off.
And this 75. Is West London, this is Ladbroke Grove
this
area.
This is West London, in the West London area.
And what sort of music were you playing initially when you got a group of people together? Was it always reggae?
It was always reggae. I had experience playing with Junior English. And in 72... I think I was very fortunate to meet one of my all-time idols, Bob Marley, and the Wailers. They came to stay in Neasden. They were supporting Johnny Nash. A long story, but I met them, took my instruments down there, and we were jamming away, and Bob came up to the door and just asked for the guitar, and that was the first time I ever heard him sing We Don't Need No More Trouble.
And you looked at him, you were sharing his space, listening to him play music, and you thought, that's the life for me then, did you? Did you always know that that's what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't. I think at that time, I had been acting for quite a few years. I'd been playing a child roles all the way.
Well, this is the double deckers.
Yeah.
I mean,
the double deckers and the Magnificent Six and a Half. I'm sure some of you remember Saturday Morning Pictures. Remember Saturday Morning Pictures? Children Film Foundation.
Yeah.
So it was at the time when I was beginning to learn about what would later be my way of life, the Rastafarian way of life.
But with the double deckers, I mean, that you were a star amongst the younger viewers of the day. So you must have thought at that time acting was going to be your life from then on. I mean, you were being given offers,
but,
I presume,
but
all
at
over
that
the place.
Time, at that time, there was very, very few parts. I mean, basically no parts for black actors. And that was my time of thinking, right, what am I going to do? I can't play a child forever. And so I think that music I was able to book a studio and go into it and take whatever I wanted to its entirety. I could finish it.
Do you remember starting as what? Do you remember a point where you think the band's underway now? We have a path to follow.
I think really seeing the album for the first time.
The first album.
Seeing the first album. I mean, I remember that the actual day I had the concept of Aswad, I was sitting in Algernon Road in Kilburn, and a friend of mine, Chester, had got this fantastic Pioneer stereo. I mean, it had 15-inch speakers. And I was listening to Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. I just came out and I went, I'm going to start a band. It's going to be the best band in the world. And there was three people there and they just laughed at me. And since I've been able to kind of go, yeah.
But you say the concept for Aswad. So what was that concept then? Inspired by taking the roots of reggae and mixing it with a bit of soul with Marvin Gaye. I mean, you were...
Well, I don't think it was about mixing. It was about most bands at that time, most reggae bands at that time, they were always kind of considered to be the poor relatives. The music was never quite authentic enough. And my idea was, unlike most of the reggae bands who were just backing bands for artists coming over from Jamaica, it was that we were going to tell our story. I mean, I was writing songs, and this is what I wanted to do.
Mm. So what were the first songs? Can you remember?
Well, it would have been something like Rebel Soul. It would have gone something like...
That was 1976. You signed to Island Records initially, which of course was the home of Bob Marley. And you felt at home at Island, I presume, because of their heritage.
I would say we thought that was great, that we had done it, we'd signed the deal. But then you have the situation that we were the first. There was no other British band that had been signed to a major label. So we would be in there and be putting things to them that they... No one knew. They were used to getting the tape from Jamaica. Mm. But now they had five young men saying, oh, we want this and we want that. And then we had lots of followers with us. So we'd arrive in Island Records in St. Peter's Square in Hammersmith with kind of like 7-8 of us turning up. So it was a different situation.
There was tension there, you mean?
I wouldn't say there was so much tension, but they didn't know what to do with us. We believe that, we always believe that making good music. And I think that in hindsight, we probably weren't aware of the business structure. And that's probably where we probably had a lot of problems.
Let's take you to 1981 and to the third album of your career, A New Chapter. And this was the first album for a new label. You'd left Island Records and you moved to CBS. So suddenly, more money behind you, you were put on a bigger stage, I presume. Was that the significance of the title, New Chapter, because you were moving on?
It was the significance of the title, but we had, at the time, the MD of Island had been Dave Bettridge, and Dave was moving over to CBS. And that's how we were taken to CBS. So we kind of went over, and yes, the album was New Chapter because it would have been our third album. Hulette was the second, and it was a different time. We thought that this was going to be the time when everything was going to be great. We would just be sail along.
So you thought, this is going to be our moment, this is going to put us on that bigger stage. Did you arrive in the studio to record that album with a set of songs ready, with a statement of intent? I mean, the album kicks off with African Children. Was that already written, for instance?
No, as most times, I think, you kind of get to the stage where you've got to do an album, and you kind of go in and it's like, oh, crumbs, okay, I've got to start thinking of a song. And I remember I was sitting, I lived in Stonebridge, in a high-rise block, right? And the kids were all playing on the landing. And I remember waiting for the lift, and there were some kids messing about there. And I went up to my floor, I think it was the 12th floor, and there was kids running around in the floor. And I just looked at them, and that was the start of African Children, right? In a concrete situation, African children. But what it was really about was the fact that kids were running about, and being living in that kind of situation.
Right.
You knew that there was problems that were never sorted. Yeah. And you got into the lift, as the lyrics say, you know, the lift stuck on the 21st floor, and when it works, it smells. It was the worst thing to get out into the lift in the morning, yeah. You know.
So that song sets the tone for the album lyrically. It puts you in a time and a place, because it's an urban album, this, and it's reflecting a lot of the worries of that a lot of black people, young people in London were thinking about at the time.
I think one of the things that we were always kind of evident was that we were telling the story from a young black point of view, but it touched everyone, because, you know, if you lived in that situation, you just didn't see black people going in and out or up and down, or, you know, it was, you had all nations there.
Mm.
So yes, we told the story from the black point of view, but we soon found out that it affected everyone.
And when you went into the studio, you're rooting the album on the roots rhythms that had come from Jamaica, but you're bringing a British aspect to the sound as well, not only lyrically, but to the sound of the album. A lot of different influences
we had been exposed to everything from the Beatles to the Rolling Stones as natural progression. We had natural progression, and on the first album it was very rootsy, right? It was like doom, 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 doom. Right, it was very rootsy. But then later on we did it on this album, New Chapter, and it has more of a, it's a different feel. It was just how we were involved, and we were trying to find different ways to say what we wanted to say.
The horn section plays a big part on this album as well. And I guess, I mean, you think about early 80s, throughout British music, there were a lot of horns. I mean, jazz funk thing was going on. There was a sort of a jazz revival scene. Did that feed in, or had you always had a horn section there?
No, we always had an idea for a horn section. But obviously, at that time, we couldn't go there. And if you listen to the second album, you'll find that we used a lot more guitars to play the horn riffs. It was a situation that the horns have always played a big part in Jamaican music. And when we had the opportunity to have horns, that's what we did.
And, I mean, without the drum and the bass line, reggae doesn't exist. You have to put that down first. But how were the songs developing at home when you're first writing? I mean, are you having to bear the rhythm in mind? Are you having to imagine that when you're writing? When you're stripping the songs back to their bare bones?
You kind of... Usually there's something that kind of triggers a song. For instance, at one time I lived in the Grove, sort of a poorly paid musician, and I hadn't paid my electricity bill. So I remember there was candles in the toilet. I remember it was late one night and it was flickering, and it was that kind of moment of like, oh no, I need to get some matches or whatever. And I just went, candles, you got to save them. And I kind of went back, probably picked up my guitar and sort of went, And usually it doesn't really start with a reggae rhythm. Usually sometimes it's just, you know, you're sitting there doodling and, you know, and it, the candles burning in the night are just like a child's life. We got to save them. Candles burning at both ends. How can they last the night? So that would have probably been the first thing, and I would have gone round and round that. And then later on, when I've kind of got more of the idea, you probably get the candles burning in the night, just like a child's life. We got to say, and then probably Drummy and Tony would come round. So I would do it, and I'd probably come up with like a line, and then Drummy will go, no, do this beat. And he did a lot of it. He played on his legs.
On his legs, sitting in the flat.
This was, in the flat when we were writing. Right. So, you know, I'd be in there and I'd be going, candles, and he'd be going, and just, we'd get beats like that. And then Tony would come up with another bass line. And then you'd get what you know as the song now. So it goes this many times. We've probably been driving. I remember one of the second single we did, we were driving through London and the police started chasing us. or following us, I should say. And we just started banging the chairs and everything, and it became Three Babylon.
You never know when inspiration's going to strike.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like, are they following us? Do you know what I mean? And it's like we turn there and they go there. And so it was, Three Babylon come to make I and I run. And someone's banging on the steering wheel. And
anybody who saw Aswad in the late 70s or early 80s knows what a formidable live unit you were. A great sense of unity at those gigs as well. Did you then go into the studio and recreate that? Did you always play live in the studio, or did you see it as a very different craft?
Aswad took the studio, right?
Onto the live stage.
Yeah. And that was it. We wanted to play dub. And no one was playing dub at that time. Mm. And that's what we wanted to do.
And these are the echo effects that you're creating.
The echo
the
effects.
You were doing
I remember having a guitar, and it was Natural Progression. It was on a TV program. Doom, doom, doom. Do, 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 do. And we're all waiting for it because we knew this echo was coming. And it should have gone. And it went. One of those things.
It was set to the wrong delay.
Yeah, it was just, no, it was an Echoplex at that time, and it was one of those things. It was a little bit of trial and error, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we'd done most of the gig, and it just got to that bit, and we've told them, right, film this bit, because it's going to be the dub bit. And
in the song Candles, you're talking about using that idea, that image, as a metaphor for the children around you, and you're writing about African children before in the song, on the first song of the album. So there is a sense of kind of childlike innocence and a wide-eyed wonder at the world throughout this album, isn't
well,
there?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily innocence. I think that it was a story that had never been told. You know, no one had really heard the story of a young black person. Normally, if you see the TV, things are done on TV or written about. But, you know, we were going through, at that time, we're going through the sus laws, where you could be picked up for just suspicion of, you know, and actually two of the others were actually taken from Oxford Street one day.
Two of the other band members?
Two of the other band members were taken and you know, they were taken and locked up. But there was a lot of different things happening at that time.
Well, in 1981, when you released New Chapter, there are riots in cities throughout Britain, the socialist unrest.
The GLC and stuff like that.
The GLC was being shut down. Yeah. And there's a lot of tension on the streets, terrible relations between the police and black youth in particular. So did you feel there was a duty then to go into the studio to write about this situation? You feel there was an obligation?
I just think that I wouldn't say that we thought there was an obligation. These were the things that were happening to us. So this is what we could write about. I think that you can have popular music. And I think this is where people lose it, that pop music is just popular music. And a lot of the companies tried to get us to, or wanted us, to just create la, 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 everything's fine. But we were talking about, for instance, Tough We Tough, right? Okay? I remember, well, you have to remember as well, this is in the early days, unless we had a gig or something, we weren't earning any money. And I remember deciding to sign on. So I kind of went along, and we had done one or two gigs, and I went along, and this was out of the blue. If this was now, I'd probably expect it. But I remember going up, standing in the queue and getting up there, and then the guy at the desk said, "Oh man, you did a gig the other day. You were playing in." Oh, I won't tell you what I said, but it was just different because, you know, I was, and in the end, I didn't. And that was another one that I came away and I went, "Tough, we're tough, enough, enough. Oh, the things we see." Because later on, it tells you about standing there waiting in a labor queue. It just blows my mind. Because they don't pay you enough, then they tell you this, then they tell you that again. In this existence, oh Lord, how must I survive? When they pay you just enough on Friday, getting you back there on Monday. And that was it. I mean, if you were working, it's a complete circle.
So you are literally seeing inspiration or getting inspiration in those situations,
well,
those everyday situations.
That's
signing on, getting chased by the police.
That's how, to me, how the songs came.
In the years since, many reggae producers and artists have cited New Chapter as an important, as a landmark album, as an influential album in the development of the sound, of the reggae sound. Were you aware that you were moving on at the time, that you were creating something that was important in that studio?
At the time, I think the furthest that we went is thinking, we've made a great album. We made a fantastic album. This is wicked. You know, a couple of months later, you kind of go, oh, no, we should have done this or we should have done that. But I think that happens with all the stuff you do, because you want, you know, and it's not until you stop and you kind of listen to it years later, because I think you've been so involved in it. And I remember for this starting to listen to some things and I went, oh, wow. You know, maybe you've changed it for live or you've done something else, but suddenly you listen to it and you kind of go, okay.
You left the band in 1996, amicably?
Yes, I think so. Yes, it wasn't like the others didn't like it at that time.
Mm. Well, because Drummy and Tony Robinson have carried on with a band
right,
called
yes.
Aswad. Is that still Aswad as far as you're concerned?
Yes, it is.
You don't worry about
it. I gave the rights. I signed over the rights for everything to them. I named the band.
And where did you get the name from?
I was looking in a book at the time. I just had a son, and I was looking in a book of African names, and it was a name that just kind of stuck out, and I went, yeah, I just loved it, that it was a word that years later people would turn around and go, what does Aswad mean? I mean, how many people know what Aswad means?
Few hands.
Is there anyone that doesn't? Anyone that doesn't know? That's it, you don't know what Aswad means? That was
probably
kind
about
of...
about half the people in the audience
that
here,
was
Brinsley,
kind
don't
of
know what
my,
it means.
My thing when I actually chose it.
Yeah.
It was a word that people will probably use and not know. The meaning of Aswad is black. It means black.
In which language?
It's Ahamaric Arabic. It's one of those words that kind of crosses over.
Right.
But it means black. I think in Arabic you've got the Khashwad stone. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly. But
the final track on the album, on New Chapter, is Love Fire. And that's a song which has had a new lease of life in the years since. It was resampled, that kind of deep bass line which drives the track was used by Dennis Brown,
mm-hmm.
and more recently
Damian Marley,
by Damian Marley, son of Bob Marley, in a track that a collaboration I think with the rapper Nas.
Yes, he did. But I mean, how that song came about, and I think that was kind of a different kind of vibe for us in those days. There was the 12 tribe dances, and One Love was kind of the saying that, you know, everyone was talking about. And I had this going around in my head, and I came up with I think I was probably learning a new chord. And this just stayed with me for quite a long time, because it's not really a reggae kind of... and not really a reggae kind of melody. And I had this going around in my head. And then I came up with, where does the fire of love kindle first? In the heart. Taking your chances, not knowing that fire burn. To give love, then risk. And then at that time, I think I'd probably just had a breakup or something. So you had that came into it. Murdered love and then tears in your eyes. So that was all going around. It was the whole idea of kind of love and that.
But it's a heavily weighted track, isn't it? Driven by that bass line.
It wasn't originally. Ah. This is what it was. It was just... And even to chop that, it was... And I never kind of did that. No, I remember we were sitting in a studio in Warren Street, right? And I think Tony was... This was going to be Tony's first album, I think. And I had said to him, do something like... Because the bass line wasn't working. And I said, do something like... Which was more of a guitar kind of feel. Do you know what I mean? And Tony started playing it. The bass line kind of started to work. And then we found a keyboard and added that kind of sound onto it. But then it was to work with that chord. Can you help me with something for a minute to do the bass line? So if you give me boom, 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 boom. I hope we're in the right key. Boom.
So we had that, right? Doom, 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 doom. And then we had Trump, keep going, because the track's still going, right? You can get up and dance if you want to, right? And then, ba-da-da-ba-da, ba-ba-ba-da-da-da. Ba da ba da da ba da da ba da da ba da da da. Ba ba da ba da ba 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 da ba ba. Ba da ba da da ba da da ba da. Keep going. Then Dennis Brown heard Drummy and Tony playing this one day on a sound check, and had just come back from Ethiopia. Okay, and he went. The promised land, take me to the promised land, to the promised land, whoa, take me to the promised land. Made a step down to Asmara, and then we stop in Addis Ababa. Made our way to Shashamani land, riding on the king's highway to the promised land. Thank you.
A live vocal dub remix of Lovefire here at Made of Earth Studios.
A lot of bass players are going to be out of business now.
I reckon. Well, you know what? This is all we have time for in this part of the programme. There's a lot more to discuss about Aswad's new chapter album and its legacy. So we'll be continuing this discussion in the second part of this edition of Master Tapes, our B-side, where our studio audience get to pose the questions. But for now, Brinsley Ford, thank you very much. Well, as Brinsley gets ready to play us out, let me remind you about the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can hear all of the programmes in the series and exclusive live versions of some of the songs we've discussed, including this one. Brinsley, what are you going to play us out with?
African Children. We always started it with something like this. African children are down there in a concrete situation. African children, they don't know where you're coming from. African children down there in a concrete situation. African children, they don't know where you're coming from. All of the nation what living in these tenements, crying and applying to their council for assistance. Their rent increasing every other day. Structural repairs are assessed and never done. Lives out of action on the 27th floor. And when it work, how it smell. African children are down there in a concrete situation. African children, they don't know where you're coming from, where you're coming from. Where you're coming from. All of the nation what living in these tenements, a precast stone wall, concrete cubicles. They're increasing every other day. Structural repairs are assessed and never done. Lives out of action on the 27th floor. And when it work out, it smell. African children down there in a concrete situation. African children, they don't know where you're coming from, where you're coming from. See, African children love to party late into the night. And when it's out of sight, the neighbors complaining again. It's a place where you don't even know your neighbor's name.
It's a ghetto in the sky. Hi, African children are down there in...